It is a great pleasure to welcome Daniel Taub to South Africa and to this show. He's an expert in international law with specialization in counterterrorism and the laws of war. He's also an Israeli diplomat and served as ambassador to the United Kingdom and as director of strategy and planning of the Yad HaNadiv, which is the Rothschild Foundation, from 2015 to 2021. He continues to write frequently on Israel and the Middle East, including many articles which have appeared in The Times, The Daily Telegraph, The Guardian, and The Huffington Post. And he brings an interesting diplomatic and legal perspective on the current issues in Israel and in the world. It's a great pleasure to have you here, Daniel. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you, Gareth. Thank you.
Nice to see you. And first of all, you've come from Israel. What are you leaving behind? What's the current status quo there?
You know, it's one of the hardest questions to answer. We're in a kind of avalanche of emotions at the moment since October the 7th. Fear, anger, frustration. I would add pride, by the way, because we see something happening in our younger generation that's quite remarkable. I'm not unusual in the fact that all of my boys and my son-in-law have been called up, left their jobs, their wives, their kids, and they're the ones that are defending us. And, you know, there's something that we realized about this TikTok generation. You know, the LL planes were full coming in and empty going out, meaning that all the backpackers in Tibet were getting back on their planes because they didn't want to leave their comrades alone as the line of defense between these terrorists and our citizens. So there's something extraordinary. And with all of the fear and the frustration and the grief, there's something that's happened in civil society, the way that people are stepping up to help each other, the unity in the country, the purposefulness, that I think is very striking indeed.
Well, you've come to South Africa, and that's probably not by chance, because South Africa has been pitted against Israel in the International Court of Justice just recently.
Right.
It's bizarre. This bizarre idea that Israel is now responsible for genocide. And being an expert in international law, perhaps we should get to this eventually, but I know that's why many people will come to hear from you this morning. Let's just quickly do an overview of your very, very interesting career. And I'd love to do it in a huge amount of detail because I'm fascinated by all the things that you have done in terms of particularly the negotiations that you were a part of with Syria, with many of the other neighbors of Israel. Notably, you said you weren't involved in Egypt and in Jordan.
The successful negotiations, my wife likes to point out.
So you weren't involved in the successful ones. But these are the most incredibly complex negotiations. And you gave an indication of this in a speech that I heard you make not so long ago about how even where the slot on a ballot box had to go in an Israeli post office in East Jerusalem so that the Palestinians and Israelis could come to terms around an election in Palestine. Right. I mean, these are the kinds of details that beg a belief and for most of us seem ridiculous, but are absolutely at the core of identity for so many of these people.
I think that's true. I think in one of the things that you learn in negotiations is that in a way, you have to leave some room for the victory speech of the other side. They need to go home with something as well. I mean, the story that you were alluding to is a sort of an extraordinary moment in our negotiations with the Palestinians, where we had an agreement that Palestinians from East Jerusalem could participate in elections, but it wasn't sure whether there should be polling stations there. The Palestinians wanted there to be, we said not yet, and so on. And so we agreed that elderly Palestinians could vote in post offices. So the Palestinians could say that this was voting in Jerusalem and Israel could say this was a postal ballot and so on. And then, as you said, it got to the absurd level where we argued whether the slot in the box should be in the top or in the side, like a post box or like a ballot box. And the compromise was to build boxes with a corner cut off at a 45-degree angle so that one side could say that the slot was at the top and one could say it was at the side. And as you say, it sounds sort of ridiculous that grown people are playing these sorts of games. But when you are talking about issues that go so close to the core of the national identity of both sides, finding some room for maneuver, finding some way to say that without compromising on my narrative, I will leave room for the story of the other side. I think is very important indeed. And just to tie it in with what you're saying, I think sadly what we see in these initiatives at the moment, and the initiative in the court is only one of them, is a really maximalist zero-sum approach that is not likely to bring peace any closer.
Meaning if you're pro-Palestinian, you must wish for the obliteration of Israel. If you're pro-Israeli, that you must wish for the obliteration of all Palestinians.
So I actually don't think there's a full symmetry there. I think the fact is that, you know, there's obviously, you know, elements on both sides that are very problematic. But I think the majority of Israelis would like nothing more than to have a prosperous, secure Palestinian neighbor that we could trade with, that we could cooperate with, and so on. And tragically, every time we've moved towards that, Hamas and its Iranian backers have done everything that they can to frustrate it, because the feeling seems to be is that they don't want a Palestinian state next to Israel. They want one instead of Israel. And so it's very difficult to think how we reach that kind of compromise.
You choose your words carefully, and I think you've had to during the course of your career, most especially as a diplomat. But give us some insight into what goes on in those rooms and how it actually works. Because for most of us, these are things that, if we have a disagreement with our spouse or our friend, we can sit down, have a fight over it, and someone gets something, someone gets the other. Just why can't you guys get things sorted out?
So I think one of the things that I take away from my time in the negotiating room is that peace is not, as people like to think, a single big thing, an enormous sea change. It is, and I think maybe people who have lived through the South African experience can appreciate this as well. It's a series of small miracles. You know, you negotiate an arrangement that maybe in itself doesn't seem so significant. You know, we negotiated in the early stages joint security patrols between Israelis and Palestinians. One jeep with Israeli soldiers, one jeep with Palestinians, maintaining security in certain places. And then you stop to remember that not long ago, the weapons on those jeeps would be facing each other. And then you suddenly realize that peace is just like one step like this after the other. And the tragedy is that trust is much easier to break than it is to build. And these types of initiatives that we're seeing today are the sort of things that break it. I'll mention, you know, you mentioned international law. In those early stages of negotiations, one of the things that was very striking to me, we really didn't know each other so well on the different sides of the table. And it was actually the lawyers on each side that had a common language, had a common skill set, that were actually reaching out to each other, that in a sense found it easier to bridge the divide. And now, unfortunately, what we're seeing is an attempt to weaponize international law, to try and turn it into a weapon in the conflict rather than to be some kind of infrastructure for building peace.
It must have been extraordinary to have people, especially in the beginning of these negotiations in the 90s, to have people sitting opposite each other who would have probably had to kill each other just a few months before, and people who only spoke the language of the other because in conflict they had either been spying on or in prison or fighting.
Exactly right. We had, in those early rounds of negotiations, we had Israelis who spoke Arabic because they'd had to interrogate terrorists, and we had Palestinians, including my counterparts in the negotiations, who spoke Hebrew because they had spent extended periods of time in Israeli jails. And the phrase, this will sound dated to you, but the phrase that we used on both sides is that you have to change the diskette. If anybody of your listeners remembers what a diskette in a computer is, you know, you take out the floppy disk and you have to put in a different kind of mind frame. You know, you have to have a different way of thinking. And I think there was, you know, tremendous frustrations, obviously, along the way, but there was some genuine courage. There was genuine leadership. And this is something else which I know South Africans will identify with. When you're talking about not just narratives, but narratives that have caused loss of life and genuine grief to both sides, to take people out of that and beyond that. And that's one of the things that, by and large, Israelis are looking for. You know, 1973 was a terrible, terrible war. You know, the war in which Israel was attacked by Egypt, by Syria, and so on, lost many, many lives. But it was just a couple of years later that President Sadat of Egypt came to Jerusalem, said no more war in the Knesset, and led to a peace agreement. And that peace agreement that was reached in 1979, nobody thought that it would survive even the transition to Mubarak. But since then, it's maybe not the warmest peace in the world, but it survived the Muslim Brotherhood, the demise of the Muslim Brotherhood. And one of the things, you know, that I draw strength from in our agreement with Jordan as well, and now, thankfully, our agreements with a number of Gulf states in the Abraham Accord, maybe it's harder to reach peace than we would like. But once you've reached it, maybe that peace is more resilient than we think. And I think there may be some hope that we can draw from that.
It's amazing to try and get your head around the fact that you, certainly you're the only one I've spoken to who has this point of view, and I think it's a novel idea in negotiation, which perhaps I'd never been exposed to before. Perhaps there are other people who know more about this, but certainly you were the one who introduced it to me. The idea that you, in your head, also have to think about the generation that came before and all of their hostilities and all of their preconceived notions of what an enemy and a friend are, and the generation that comes after. So you're not just there to represent yourself in the present. You're there for the past and the future as well.
Sure. Just the way that I sometimes put it is that, you know, international negotiations are really three levels of negotiation in one. You have the negotiation, the classic negotiation across the table between me and you, between Israelis and Palestinians. But then on each side of the table, you'll have the Ministry of Defense wanting the security arrangements. You'll have the Ministry of Finance wanting to know how much it costs, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and so on. And so there's a tug of war along the side of the table. And that's called the negotiation along the table. And then at a certain stage, if you make progress, there's what's called the negotiation behind the table. That is the negotiation with the people that sent you, how you persuade your leaders or your constituency that this is an agreement that's worth signing. And that's an analysis in a lot of classic texts of international negotiation. And I think my personal takeaway from years in the negotiation room is that there's another dynamic, a fourth dynamic, that takes place within each negotiator in the room. And that, as you say, is a negotiation between the past and the future, between our loyalty to those that came before us, the voices of the grandparents, and the voices of the grandchildren. And the question is, can we find the courage to make those voices more compelling? And Israelis really want to feel that that's a common effort. But one of the things that has been so terribly shattered is the realization that we are, at least at the moment, with Hamas up against an enemy that is not particularly concerned about the voices of the grandchildren. They are building an entire network of terror tunnels, 450 miles, longer than the London Underground, where the exits come up under children's cots, in kindergartens, in hospitals. There was a case where a four-year-old girl was found by Israeli troops because the Hamas terrorists had sent her up through the tunnel entrance to check whether the road was clear. I mean, you think about the lack of concern, and it's so profoundly damaging to our hope that at least in thinking about a better future for our kids, and we don't think this is the situation for all Palestinians, but at the moment, these are the ones that are leading the charge against us, and it's very depressing.
It doesn't take a majority to propel people forwards or backwards.
Look, the tragedy, in a way, the tragedy of the world is it's so much easier to pull things down than to build them up.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to acknowledge, you know, we're in a country here where there's a lot of noise on the pro-Palestinian side. There are marches, there are people who speak very publicly about their condemnation of Israel, that the war must be, that there must be a cease and desist immediately. Israel must take its chances with whatever's happened and get out, because women and children are being killed and there's huge damage on the sides, and actually it's become a very mean conflict. And I want you to talk to those pro-Palestinians, because you've addressed pro-Palestinian groups before, and I'd like to know what you'd say to a South African. Fortunately, I don't think the majority of South Africans are that deep into either side. fortunately or unfortunately, because it is the world. And most people are just concerned with their own stuff. But if you met one of these South Africans who are very pro-Palestine, what would you say?
So first of all, I meet these people very often. And often they are motivated by genuinely humanitarian, caring emotions and so on. And I respect that. But really what I would ask them to think deeply about is, what does it mean to be pro-Palestinian? Who are you actually supporting? I mentioned to you offline a situation that I had in a lecture in the United States where I was disrupted by a group of pro-Palestinian demonstrators who tried to disrupt the lecture. And I had my laptop with me. And so I fished up a short video clip from a previous round of fighting in Gaza. And on this clip, you see a Hamas terrorist with a gun on his back who is hiding between buildings. And he needs to cross a road and he knows he's going to be exposed if he steps out. So in this brief clip, you see him grab hold of a Palestinian kid who is maybe 6 or 7 years old and grasp him in front of him literally as a human shield till he reaches the other side of the road. And then he casts him aside and goes back between the buildings. And so I said to the demonstrators, I said, I don't have a problem with you being Palestinian supporters. Palestinians need support around the world. But I do want to know which of those two Palestinians you're supporting. Are you supporting that Hamas terrorist? Are you supporting that kid who's not going to be able to grow up with any vision of life different from the one that he's living in? And I have to say, I think one of the difficulties with the initiative of the South African government is that it portrays itself as a pro-Palestinian initiative, but it really isn't. And first of all, the proof of it is that we haven't heard the voice of this government in relation to the brutal massacre of thousands of Palestinians in Syria.
No, not
we haven't heard their voice in relation to the horrendous abuse of the lives of Palestinians under Hamas.
No.
And if that's the case, you know, it's not for me to judge the political considerations, but I would certainly urge someone to consider if they...
Well, it's my government, and sure. I will judge them, and I think that the mask has fallen. We were told in the beginning by people like our Minister of International Relations that we were pro-Palestinian, not pro-Hamas, which I thought was an acceptable place for us to be. You can choose which side you're on. I don't agree, but that's adequate, and I could deal with that. But very shortly thereafter, Hamas were invited here and received as heroes, and our regard for them is warm and friendly. This is an international terror organization. Our government cannot now pretend that they are unbiased actors in that space. It's become impossible. We know which one of the two, the young child or the Hamas soldier,
that helped. That makes sense to me. You know, I think there's a pretty good litmus test for whether a country or an individual has standing to criticize Israel for its operations. And Israel deserves to be criticized and engaged with and have these discussions. And that litmus test is what you said between October the 7th and October the 10th.
Yeah.
In those days, immediately after the most horrendous massacre, rape, mutilation.
Where we were just dealing with hideous
death. Israel
yeah.
had even begun any sort of response right. whatsoever. And if in those days, like members of the South African government, you were congratulating Hamas and already blaming Israel for what you called the conflagration, then you had a verdict that was looking for a crime. And I think you have lost any moral standing to point the finger at anybody.
And that verdict looking for a crime is perhaps what leads us to the ICJ.
Sure.
But before that, I think it's also important to take note of something else to do with this situation and this conflagration that mm-hmm. our government speak of. And so many people all over the world say, oh, well, the Middle East, it's this ongoing mm-hmm. thing. And it just seems to be this never-ending stalemate, or there's violence on this side, or there's violence and retaliation, justification, defense on the other side. That's not the case. There have been very good episodes in the history of Israel's relations.
I would add to that, the Hamas violence spikes when there is progress towards peace. It's not, you know, when there is actual, at the time that we had the closest negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. That was when Hamas upped its suicide bomber attacks. Again, you know, to the Palestinian supporter, I would urge them to look at how many missiles Hamas fires at the crossing points into Gaza to disrupt the humanitarian aid, because they are invested in the perpetuation of poverty and hardship and so on. So I think it's no coincidence that this round of violence, this horrendous round of violence, which took place, by the way, when Israel was engaged in all sorts of economic outreach to the Gaza Strip. We had 18,000 Palestinians a day coming into Israel from Gaza to work in Israel. We had many people ferrying Palestinians from the border for medical treatment, you know, who had volunteers who had learned Hebrew for that purpose, many of whom tragically were killed or taken hostage.
Many of those people who were killed in southern Israel were big supporters of these outreaches.
But the point I want to say is I don't think it's a coincidence that this happened at a time that there's been such a rapprochement, such a warming of relations between Israel and Arab states in the Gulf, and even the beginnings of a warmer relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
The notion that Hamas and its Iranian sponsors are interested in peace or even interested in statehood. I mean, the people who were engaged in that massacre on October the 7th were not shouting, "End the occupation," or "Give us a better education," or even "Give us a state." They were shouting, "Allahu Akbar." And that's deeply troubling.
So the ICJ situation, because we're in South Africa and sure, this was something that we were supposedly spearheading, whether or not we were asked to do so by a foreign actor is a whole different question. What are your feelings on why this charge was leveled at Israel, first of all, and what you think was really going on behind the scenes, and then also what you think the best and worst arguments for it would be?
So first of all, I think we have to look at this for a moment in the longer term. And the longer term is that we know that the campaign against Israel by extremist Palestinians, by Palestinians that aren't interested in peace, has adopted for a couple of decades now a strategy that some people call lawfare, which is trying to harness judicial legal instruments as part of its campaign. And it's really a pincer movement. And the pincer movement works on the one hand by creating absolutely impossible, excruciating dilemmas on the ground for any country trying to defend itself. If we embed our Hamas center under the head of the UN office in Gaza, if we have our terrorist headquarters under the Shifa Hospital, then Israel will either have to allow us to perpetrate attacks with impunity, or it will respond and there will be collateral civilian casualties and they will give us some kind of sick PR advantage. So that is one arm of the pincer movement. And the other is to try to expand the political circle of influence in the UN, which for many years was limited to the General Assembly, the political debating society. And then it expanded to the human rights organs of the United Nations. I mean, if anybody follows what happened during the 80s and 90s to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, you know, which became such a travesty, it's still today, in any given year, it passes more resolutions condemning Israel than every other country in the world combined. You know, that's including China and North Korea and Syria and, you know, Yemen. And if you think about it, the victims of that politicization are not Israelis. The real victims are those victims of human rights abuses elsewhere in the world that never get attention because the dictatorial regimes want to turn the spotlights away from themselves. And now what we've seen over the last couple of decades is an attempt to expand that circle still further to the judicial organs of the international community, including the International Criminal Court in The Hague and the International Court of Justice. And these proceedings are not bringing those courts any credit at all. They are forcing them to twist their jurisdiction in all sorts of convoluted ways. You know, the previous proceedings, we have a number of proceedings in front of the International Court of Justice, and they get in through the back door. You know, they get through, there'll be a request from the General Assembly for an advisory opinion, and before you know it, and so on and so forth. And the rulings themselves are amongst the I would say, the least substantiated international law rulings.
Most of the countries that are really powerful and influential in the world don't even subscribe to those courts.
It depends which court, but certainly I think it's true that the people who are in favor of these initiatives should look at who their allies are. They should look at who are the countries that are supporting them, and they should ask themselves, are these the builders or are these the destroyers? Are these the ones who are protecting human rights or are looking for ways of shielding themselves? So this particular proceeding in relation to genocide, it's an obscene rewriting of the crime of genocide. First of all, there was a genocide on October the 7th. And we know it not just because of the 1,200 people that were brutalized, murdered, raped, and the hostages, but we know it because of the manuals that the Hamas terrorists had with them about where they wanted to go and the charter that calls for the destruction of Jews elsewhere. And yet the idea is to flip that and to try to project that onto Israel. I would say even from a short visit here in South Africa, one of the things that's been really striking to me is how different much of the media's presentation of the preliminary decision of the court is from what the court actually wrote.
Oh, yeah. Cherry-picking in its...
I mean, I would really urge anybody just to read it. It's written in very clear language. You know, first of all of these statements that, you know, hooray, the court has found that Israel is plausibly committing genocide. The judges repeatedly, again and again, in their unanimous opinion, in their individual opinion, say, we cannot even begin to engage with this subject yet. It's, you know, we don't have the facts. That's a part of a longer proceeding. And most importantly, you know, what Hamas really wanted here and what, sadly, the South African government was an accessory to was an attempt to tie Israel's hands, was to try and leave Hamas in place, leave its tunnels in place, its weaponry in place, and have a cessation of operations. That was the real goal. And every single judge, including the Lebanese judge, including the Somali judge, agreed that that was an unacceptable request. Israel needs to be allowed to defend itself in accordance with international law. And not only that.
You wouldn't know that reading any of our newspapers.
And something else, sadly, that I haven't seen was that in addition to the requests that South Africa included in its application, the court decided to add an additional demand that wasn't in that request, which was for the immediate and unconditional release of all of the Israeli hostages. Yeah. And if South Africa has such respect for the court and it has influence over Hamas, where is its work to release those hostages, including, by the way, at least one hostage who has South African citizenship?
You know,
that to me is amongst everything else, disrespectful of the court's decision.
That would be a good argument if anyone cared about evidence. I mean, we can laugh about it, but it's deeply, deeply distressing.
Absolutely.
And I'm concerned about the fact that we've almost entered this post-truth world where narrative does matter more than fact. And even when you try to proffer a version of history which is not at all true, if you can get enough people to believe it, it becomes the truth. You know, it's one of those lies that gets ahead of the truth so fast that the truth can't get dressed in time. We in this country seem to be especially susceptible to a very one-sided pro-Palestinian narrative, and our media don't help us because they're not particularly curious about the facts. Are you afraid that in the international community, Israel is losing the PR war?
So I think there's a lot of causes for concern. I think, you know, simply to take the fact that here we are 4 months after the most horrendous atrocity was committed against Israel. And it hasn't stopped. We've had thousands of missiles fired not from just from Gaza, but from 6 different fronts, including Yemen, you know, Houthis fighting, they're firing, you know, Syria, Lebanon, and so on. And the hostages kept, you know, treated abysmably.
Well, we don't know how many of them even alive. Crime.
You know, the medical medical supplies, as far as we know, never reached them, or maybe only just now, months later, and so on. And after that, it seems that so much of the world, the finger is pointed against Israel for defending itself. And in that case, I really do feel that the war Israel is fighting is, in a way, it's a war for international law, to prove that international law is not a suicide pact. You know, if we cannot show that while respecting international law as best we can provide an effective response to this obscene, cynical form of terrorism, then like so many other forms of terrorism, we will see it copycatted across into other arenas around the world. I do think we have some assets on our side, I have to say. And the first is the reality. I would simply invite people to come to the region, to visit Israel, warts and all, speak to Israelis, hear their aspirations, hear their concern for the Palestinians, hear the fact that we genuinely want to provide them with health services. We genuinely want to reach out in any way that we can. And if you can, hear the voices of dissent within Palestinian society, although Hamas does everything possible to make sure that you won't hear them. I mean, the previous head of the Reuters bureau in Gaza, now, after he left, came out and admitted not a single picture, not a single story comes out of Gaza unless Hamas signs off on it. And so, but I think the reality, in a sense, is our greatest asset. And if that's the case, at some stage it will show through. And I think we have one other asset, which is a general rule, the people that are on, I don't want to call it the Israeli side because I believe it's the Palestinian side as well, if we're thinking about the genuine interest of the Palestinians, are forward-looking, have a vision. And the only thing that unites the people against us is a manic call for hatred and destruction. You know, sometimes I visit universities and I met as an Israeli speaker with a demonstration outside the lecture hall. And if you look at the makeup of that demonstration, it's an unusual coalition. It's by and large radical leftists and fundamentalist jihadists. Some people call it the Red-Green Alliance.
Right.
And if you want to break down that coalition, I think all you have to do is say, look, I know what it is you're against. Can you please tell me what it is that you're for? Are you in favor of women's rights? Are you in favor of freedom of expression? Are you in favor of gay rights? And all of a sudden, that coalition just disintegrates before your very eyes. And my challenge, you know, to the friend of the Palestinians and to the people of South Africa, I would say is, you know, there is one natural resource that we don't have a shortage of in our region, and that is negative energy. We don't need other people to export more negative energy to our region. What do you have that is positive that you can invest into our region? You, the people of South Africa, have been through an extraordinary period of reconciliation, of leadership, of societal growth. Those are skills that we can learn from. You know, and there are people that stop to think about it. There's so much hostility and sort of mindless negativity on campuses. But here and there, you come across projects. You know, MIT in Boston has a wonderful project, which is called MEET, where they send professors of computer science to the region to teach advanced programming to teenaged Palestinians and Israelis. And these young Israelis and Palestinians together set up little companies and provide services to businesses in the region. And what I love about this program is not just that it's such a great thing to do in educating people, but these professors in MIT have taken a moment to think, what is our added value? What can we add to the equation? And at some point, you know, maybe there are political considerations that I don't understand, but at some point, the people that are engaged in these negative initiatives, these campaigns, have to go home and look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, what have I really added? What have I really done for the benefit of the peoples of the region?
I couldn't have said it better. This again proves that you're a man of extraordinary experience in this regard. I can't help thinking how we've squandered as South Africans our moral capital that we had so much of post 1994, showing the world that you can enter a new dispensation with a history of conflict and hostility. You can find a way to come together and create a vision for the future. And perhaps it was the quality of our leaders. I'd be willing to give them all the credit. Perhaps it was the quality of the meeting of you know, the old divisions and surrendering that for a future that was better than anything we could do individually on either side of that argument. But it seems to me that we've somehow lost our way, and instead of adding moral capital to our treasure chest, we've decided to squander and to keep on digging by backing some of the very worst actors in the world. I mean, we started doing this. We started going down the wrong path when Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a man of huge moral excellence, I think undoubtedly all over the world, regarded as a good person by friend and foe, couldn't have his friend the Dalai Lama come to visit because China had said, no, you won't. And our government capitulated to that. And ever since then, we've chosen to be friends with Iran, with Russia, with all of the countries that seem to be on the debit rather than the credit side of things. And now with Israel. Are you concerned about the much bigger specter of what looms always behind anything to do with Israel? And that is because people will have their arguments against Zionism, have their arguments against the way Israel works within, you know, the coalition politics, mm-hmm. the left and the right. Many Israelis are conflicted in that respect. But almost inevitably, anti-Semitism rears its head. And we see it boggles my mind that so few people bother to read history books, but we see it rising again all over the world and in places that we didn't expect it to, the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe. These are countries that have some answering to do for what occurred 70, 80 years ago. But anti-Semitism is a real thing. And also to draw a distinction between anti-Semitism and this idea of Islamophobia, because people are trying to equate them. And Islamophobia is a made-up term. There are people who are hostile to Muslims, but Islamophobia is a new invention.
So I have to say there have been so many, many shocking elements of the last few months, but at the global level for the Jewish people, probably the most shocking has been the spontaneous outbreak of riots around the world on October the 7th, meaning before Israel had responded.
Yeah.
When the response to a pogrom, there is no other word, against the Jewish people, was for people to join in the fray. And I think it's fair to add, as hard as it is to say this, I think it's an important part of the picture. Of the 3,000 people that crossed the border and mutilated and butchered Israelis, only 1,500 of them were members of Hamas. Another 1,500 were people that went along for the ride. And that also is a deeply, deeply, as much as we hold on to the hope, the belief that there are Palestinian people who love their children as much as we do, who want the future as much as we do, these are hard things to get our mind around. And to see this anti-Semitism, you know, what people have called this sleeping giant, resurfacing around the world. I'll be honest, sometimes I don't like to use the word anti-Semitism because I think it sets the bar too low. I don't want to create a situation where somebody only needs to prove in some way they're not anti-Semitic and then they can have double standards in relation to Israel. I would like Israel to be treated, and Israel deserves to be treated, in the same way as any other country, which means that if we fall short of international standards, we should be held to account. You know, and we do that ourselves. I mean, if you want to know what the core difference is between Hamas and Israel, you just have to ask for which side is a casualty on any side of failure, and for which side is a casualty on any side of success. And that's the moral chasm between the two. But I think you need to have that discussion. We need to have that debate. But if you have a double standard, if you decide that every refugee in the world is going to be looked after by a single refugee organization, and only the Palestinian refugees will be looked after by a separate organization that has its own definition, because you don't want the refugee population to disappear, but you want it to expand from generation to generation. Even if you're a minister in a government in a foreign country, you're still a Palestinian refugee. You know, that is, it's an absurd, absurd situation. So I really do think that we need to demand fairness. We just want to be treated fairly. And we're deprived of the opportunity. It's interesting. We do have deep soul-searching debate with the militaries of Western countries about the operations that we're in and the methods that we're using. And I want to tell with you that recently in this round of conflict, I've spoken to a number of senior commanders, the former military commander of British forces in Afghanistan, the head of urban warfare in West Point, and so on. And they say a number of things. The first thing that they say is they are not aware of an environment of combat as complex, as treacherous, as cynical as the one that we are facing in Gaza ever in history. And the second thing that they say is that they are not sure that other Western militaries would take all of the same precautions that Israel is taking in order to limit the lives of civilian casualties. You know, dropping the thousands of leaflets, making the thousands of phone calls. In the early days of this operation, Israel delayed its ground incursion into Gaza for 3 weeks to try to allow the evacuation of civilians, even though Hamas was doing everything it could to stop them, stealing their car keys, bombing the roads, and so on and so forth. And doing that meant that Israel was increasing the risks to the lives of its own soldiers. It was increasing the risks that the terrorists would move, that the hostages would move, that the ammunition would be moved. That doesn't mean that we get it right in every situation, but I think the difference is that we're asking the right questions. And we have those dialogues with representatives of Western militaries, but the international organizations that should also be part of that dialogue have lost the credibility because they have chosen to politically ally themselves, as you say, with a particular side, and that's not the side that's building, that's the side that's destroying.
Just as a final thought, you're an expert in the laws of war. And people often cite the Geneva Conventions and they say, well, Israel's gone too far. I mean, these are critics of Israel, obviously. You also mentioned that some of these military experts you've spoken to have not been able to identify a single conflict in human history where the consequences of a civilian death are as dire for the attacking force and where that force is faced with more perilous circumstances, the terrain,
and
the kinds of warfare.
It's a few meters away. It's not away in Afghanistan or Iraq. I think that's also relevant.
If Israel didn't have its Iron Dome, and if they weren't a country of conscription where women and men have to go and serve, and many are now volunteering again to do so, I mean, what chance would they stand? What sketch a scenario for us where Israel were not as prepared, and there are questions about how prepared they might have been on the 7th and so on. But now, in the situation of conflict, what might have happened if Israel were not ready to go?
So we are currently called on to rethink some pretty core paradigms of thinking that have accompanied us for quite a long time. And one of them, you mentioned Iron Dome. Iron Dome, for your listeners, is this extraordinary technology that Israel developed, which basically shoots incoming missiles out of the sky. And it's one of a range of missile systems that do that. And it was reflective of a hope that we would not need to go into Gaza, that we could protect ourselves defensively. If we could shoot the missiles out of the sky, if we had a technology to detect the tunnels that were coming into Israel, if we had a fence that could stop infiltrations, then that would be enough. And the tragedy in a sense, or one of the tragic misconceptions turns out to be that you cannot live side by side with a Iranian-sponsored, funded, weaponized terrorist regime that is building this subterranean, you know, edifice of death. I think that one of the reasons that it's critical that Israel win this battle, and there are many, is that if it is perceived to be a victory for Hamas, for Iranian proxies, this will whet the appetite of their allies, the proxies in the region, and say, you know, this country is not as much of a fixture in the region as we thought before. And that's a very, very scary thought. That's why they really need to be seen to be degraded, come for the future, both for the future of the Palestinian people and for the future of, I mean, one of the dilemmas you talked about, Israel's messaging, one of the reasons why it's so hard for Israel to have a coherent message is because at root we want to be loved by the West, but we need to be feared by our enemies in the region. And it's very difficult to broadcast those messages simultaneously. But with all of the bewildering and shocking developments of the last few months, there have been a couple that have been encouraging. And, you know, the eve of October the 7th, Israel was probably at its most internally divided than it's been in the history of the state. You know, we had internal debates over what now seems a sort of almost preposterous issue. It was the nature of Israeli democracy and the nature of judicial reform and so on and so forth. But the country was really being torn apart. And there were people that were saying the pilots who were demonstrating against the government will never show up, and these soldiers who were demonstrating will never support the government. On October the 7th, by 10 o'clock in the morning, the pilots were in the air. By the afternoon, these groups that were demonstrating, that already had their infrastructure because they were demonstrating against the government, had set up these emergency rooms to help evacuees, to help hostage families, and so on and so forth. There has been a sharpening of the focus in Israeli society that this is about us, it's about our future, it's about our children. We have no choice. You know, Amos Oz, the famous Israeli writer, once wrote, you know, my father left Europe when the graffiti on the walls was "Go to Palestine." And he went back for a visit 50 years later and the graffiti on the walls was "Get out of Palestine." And, you know, there is a sort of clarity now that this is, you know, a popular Israeli song is "We have no other country." And so I think that's given a tremendous sense of purpose, a tremendous resilience. And we are deeply, deeply grateful to everybody in the international community. And that includes the many, many people in South Africa. And even from this short visit, I know that the South African government doesn't represent, you know, a very large part of South African public opinion, of those people who want to stand next to us in this battle.
Well, I can't think of a better place to end this conversation than on that positive note, because I think it's true. And I'm so grateful that you managed to make time to speak to me today. Daniel Taub, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And thank you for helping us to understand, giving us some clarity on what it's like to be in the room during some of these negotiations, what it's like to be in Israel during this conflict, and what those larger questions mean for all of us, especially for those people who will try to hide their heads in the sand. We're all going to be called to choose at some point. And that dynamic doesn't necessarily mean that you can't be sympathetic to the other side, that you can't treat people as being equal, that you can't have some regard for the suffering of your enemy. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.